Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guests today are the author and Buddhist scholar Stephen Batchelor and the philosopher Robert N. Ellis. For those of you who don't know, is the chair of the Middle Way Society. And the topic of the discussion today is the Middle Way itself and their understanding of it. A warm welcome back to you both to the MWS podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so just before we start, Stephen, what have you been up to since we last spoke on the podcast around a year ago? And I know you've been working on a book for a while now. Is that near completion?
It's actually completed all bar the copy editing. I finished it the end of last year.
Yeah.
And it's going to be called After Buddhism. We're still negotiating the subtitle, if there is to be one. It'll come out with Yale University Press, so it'll be a much more scholarly and, somewhat more reliable book than my usual productions, hopefully. And I've enjoyed writing it enormously because it's a book that's actually tried to pull together a lot of the different strands in my writing and thinking that I've been developing really for about the last 40 years. So it's quite a thick book, I'm afraid, but I'm quite happy with it. And it should come out in the autumn of this year. In fact, we're already scheduling a book launch in London on the 31st of October, if anybody happens to be around.
Okay, well, look forward to reading it, Tim. And you, Robert, what have you been involved with lately?
Well, I've also just completed a thick book. that is Middle Way Philosophy 4, The Integration of Belief, which is the final book in my Middle Way Philosophy series of four volumes, which is thoroughly exploring Middle Way Philosophy, which brings together the Middle Way, integration, embodied meaning, a variety of different perspectives. And the latest one is particularly about cognitive biases and fallacies and the ways we can work with them to integrate belief. After the publication of my introductory book, Migalism, early last year, so I've now got a further sort of explanation of the approach together with an introduction. So
really?
I've got both of those under my belt now.
Great stuff. Okay, well, should we get started then? Could I ask you to begin, Stephen, by telling us what your understanding is of the Middle Way?
Well, okay, I'll try and be as brief as possible. Obviously, this is a very central idea if you are going to declare yourself in any shape, form or colour as being a Buddhist. And I do. I don't know whether Robert does or not, but I do. And I've thought a great deal about this idea ever since I came across it when I first came across Buddhism, basically. Yeah. But I think it boils down to two things for me. First of all, it has to do for me with very much about the idea of integration. In other words, it's quite clear from the Buddha's earliest discourses that the middle way is equivalent to the Noble Eightfold Path. That's more or less a basic starting point.
Yeah.
And the way I understand the Eightfold Path is very much in terms of trying to live a human life that engages all of our capacities of how we think, how we see the world, how we motivate ourselves, how we speak, how we act, how we work. In other words, everything that comprises our humanity, but in a way that is somehow integrated. And I arrive at the idea of integration here through my reflections upon the meaning of the word samā, now, which is usually translated as right, and so you get right view, right thought, right this, right that. I've never been happy with that translation at all. It has a sort of moralistic twang to it, and it presupposes its opposite, right, wrong. I don't think that's so helpful, at least in every aspect of our life. I don't think that's a particularly useful paradigm. The word itself, samā, quite clearly, means complete. I mean, there's no argument about that. I mean, that's what the word means. And so you get many, many, many usages in Pali, like the complete ending of dukkha, is samma-kayak. So it's the same word. So I explored thinking of this more in terms of complete and remembering that the English word integral is based on the Latin integer, which means a whole number. So what does it mean, therefore, for a view to be samma, to be complete? I take it more now to mean that it is a view that is integrated into a whole. In other words, your views and your thoughts and your work and your life are not hived off into special areas, which our society is very good at doing.
Yeah.
But rather, it's a constant attempt, no doubt one at which we're always failing, but to try to bring the whole of our life into a coherent vision, in which how we speak and how we live and how we work are all somehow held together or working together towards the realization of what we consider to be the good. In other words, to me, the Eightfold Path in Middle Way is really essentially an ethical idea. It's about realizing what we conceive of as a good life or a life in which we're able to optimally flourish as human beings. That's my first broadest understanding of a middle way life.
Yeah.
The other point, the other angle I would take on this, again, is coming from early Buddhist suttas. In this case, what's called the Kacchanaguta Sutta, the discourse to Kacchanaguta, which is in the Sanyutta Nikaya, and is the basis for a lot of what Nagarjuna speaks of in his karikas, in his verses on the middle way. And this passage is one, again, I've pondered for a long, long time. And it has to do with conceiving of the middle way as a perspective on life that is not dominated or predicated on the concepts of is and is not, or ati and nati. This is very, very clear in the text. I think it's a beautiful passage. I don't want to go into that right in any detail here. But what that points to is that a middle way approach is also one that seeks to avoid any kind of fixity or attachment to a particular position, whether that's an affirmation or whether that's a negation. Now, this to me ties very much into what I also feel is a very central part of a middle way approach, and that is one that that values and encourages the imagination and creativity. We remember, if you remember also in the Buddha's first sermon, when he speaks of the middle way, the fourth noble truth, so-called, he speaks of it as something that has to be bhavetava, cultivated, developed, brought into being, literally. So the practice of the middle way is actually the practice of bringing it into being. And bringing something into being means to create it. Yeah. The middle way is not lying ahead of us passively waiting to be trodden upon, but the middle way is a possibility that is available to us in each moment to realize, whether that's in our views, in our thoughts, in our words, in our acts. It's an ongoing, constant practice that requires us to treat much more lightly and perhaps ironically the views and the opinions that we so easily get attached to and stuck in. This activates, to me, a kind of perplexity, a kind of curiosity, a kind of willingness to question. And here I'm tapping back into my Zen background rather than into the more classical Pali tradition. But what to me this points to is, if we're not invested in either is or is not, being or non-being, we're also, in a sense, open to the fact of the world as being fundamentally, in some sense, mysterious, undefinable, unpin-downable in that way. Yeah. And our response to it, therefore, is something that requires not just the replication or the repetition of a certain habit of mind or a certain religious belief, but it has to do with actually responding appropriately to the uniqueness and the specificity of a particular situation or occasion. And that requires imagination, that requires creativity. And I see, therefore, the practice of the middle way is one that is, on the one hand, aspiring to integration, and on the other hand, always being open to uncertainty and mystery.
Okay, well, thank you for that, Stephen. Over to you, Robert.
Okay, right. That's very interesting, Stephen, and there's obviously some more things in your new book, which I haven't read before, in your others, which will be quite exciting developments. So there's a lot I can relate to there. and certainly what you talk about, the importance of integration, which is a major theme of my own work, and obviously the middle way as, well, recognising the world as mysterious and as not dominated by fixed beliefs. That's also very much in harmony with how I would interpret the middle way. I guess a lot of where we differ, or where I suspect we differ, is a matter of style and approach, and you seem to be particularly an interpreter of the Buddhist tradition. What I'm trying to do is take it out of that tradition, really. So to take insights that I have gained from the Buddhist tradition and other places and create a model of the middle way which is more adequate to a universal model, really, that's applicable to a variety of circumstances without any appeals to the Buddhist tradition or interpretation necessarily of the Buddhist tradition. So unlike you, I wouldn't tie the middle way to the Noble Eightfold Path, for that reason that I see the Noble Eightfold Path as a particular kind of development, particular kind of formula used in Buddhism, which can be helpful in that tradition, but isn't nearly as universal in its application as the middle way itself. So the middle way, I would see, is as a universal principle. Obviously, we have to have a name for it from somewhere, and Buddhism has provided me with a name for it. But I would suggest that there is a middle way in lots of other places, in science, in Christianity, in many other traditions, that implicitly or explicitly. And so as to how I would define it, broadly speaking, any definition has its limitations, of course, but I see it as a principle of judgment, primarily. So it's a way in which we approach, well, interpreting the flux of experience and forming judgments about what we assume to be the case out of that flux of experience. And so it's a principle of judgment that avoids metaphysical extremes, so either positive or negative metaphysical extremes. So, I mean, that seems to me to be a, you know, flexible and universal way of talking about the middle way.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously the value of that is that by avoiding delusions of the kinds represented by those positive and negative extremes, you can address conditions more effectively.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a very wide thing we're talking about, that you know, any person at any point could potentially judge in a slightly better way if they avoid the dogmas represented by the positive and negative extremes. And I also think that those delusions on either side, positive or negative, are absolutizations. And that's, so rather than the emphasis which you get in, I assume that you're largely inspired by Nagarjuna here, talking about is and is not. I mean, I'd see that as obviously an element that you find in many metaphysical views. But psychologically, and that's where I think the universal element is, it's an absolutization or a tendency to think that, or assume that the particular representation of the world you've got at this point is the right one and the end of the story. That's the right conclusion. And drawing that conclusion requires an assumption of a perfect perspective, which we don't actually have. And you can relate that closely to the left and right hemisphere issues of the brain, that the left hemisphere has this tendency to conceptualize in a particular way for particular goals and then get stuck, being particularly where it's over-dominant, not allowing new stimuli through the right hemisphere to question it or to provide new basis of thinking. So it can get stuck either in a positive way, asserting something, or it can get stuck in a negative way by denying something just as easily. And that's a point which I think tends to get neglected in a lot of discussions of the middle way, that it's easy for people to try and use the middle way or to appeal to it, and yet if you don't have a lot of care and even-handedness, then it's easy just to get into a more or less negative position, or if you're doing it with the assumption of some sort of traditional dogma perhaps, then what you can end up with can just be an expression of that if you're not very careful and critical in the way you apply it. And obviously the middle way is also not just a theory, it's tied in with practice. So to avoid it just being another absolutization itself, it has to have a continual interrelationship with practice that informs it and continues to challenge any particular conceptions we get on the basis of our experience. But in order to avoid falling into dogmas. We need, well, I think both continual review, but also firmness in not accepting metaphysical interpretations.
No, that sounds great. But on the other hand, when you speak and you try to universalize this idea of the middle way, which I am very sympathetic to, nonetheless, everything you've said so far has, to me, got a very Buddhistic spin to it. And I'd like to hear from you some examples in other traditions where we find this similar principle, as you consider it to be, clearly stated.
Right. Well, I suspect it's perhaps not as clearly stated in most traditions as it is in Buddhism, and I think you can find it implicitly sometimes. But very often it's also a question of finding what is positive and provisional and helpful in a wide range of sources. But obviously, I mean, there is something we can get from scientific method in terms of the need for provisionality, which science recognises. So it's the need to use evidence in supporting our views, yes, but also to be willing to revise those views. So that's a kind of scientific attitude, which may be used by scientists in formal academic science, but may also be adopted by individuals in that kind of scientific tradition. And I don't think, in some ways, science seems to articulate that better, or at least people inspired by science seem to articulate it better often than Buddhists do, because I've yet to see a really helpful Buddhist account of provisionality and what provisionality actually is, even though it's often assumed that, Nagarjuna, say, has a provisional view of the world. Science seems to articulate that better. But if you want to think about other religious traditions, for example, I think there are some ways where, with a great deal of interpretation, one could gain a middle way out of Christianity. I think it takes interpretation in Buddhism as well. It's just a question of how much. It takes selectivity and on the basis of what one believes to be helpful. But where I'd find it potentially in Christianity is in the incarnation. So this constant balancing between the divine and the human. And so this very difficult balancing act mix, which Christians have tried to wrestle with through the centuries, between trying to fit in with these perfect rules of God on the one hand and recognizing humanity and its weakness and sinfulness and so on the other. So if you can somehow live in that space instead of jumping to dogmas about how Jesus already saved you or whatever, then I think it's possible to come to middle way like positions through that kind of process.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, we also have the Western skeptical tradition going back to Pyrrha. Yeah. There, I think you find actually, although he doesn't use the word middle way, the fragments that we have of Pyrrha that are perhaps reliable suggest again finding a position in which neither is nor is not, both or neither, the tetralemma. And seeing that not just as a sort of a metaphysical game or an intellectual exercise, he sees it as what will lead us to aphatos and to ataraxia, in other words, to a state of speechlessness in which conceptuality and any kind of opinions are suspended, and that leading to a trouble-free state of mind, which is very close, I think, in many ways, to the Buddhist understanding of nirvana. And that's a tradition, that's a connection that I'm very much interested in trying to pursue, to see how through the classical schools of skepticism, and then we see that revived, say, in Montaigne, and we see it carried on through the European Enlightenment, then, as you say yourself, and I completely agree with you, how that approach, that skeptical approach, is fundamental to the whole scientific endeavor. And also, I picked up your reference to the two sides of the brain and so on, and no doubt you have Ian McGilchrist's book in mind. And again, that, I think, reinforces very much. It gives us a great deal of a very, very, I think, compelling foundation for this sort of middle way approach. But I still feel when I hear you speak that in some ways, and this is perhaps a criticism you'd get more from people who weren't Buddhists, but nonetheless, you're taking a Buddhist concept, which we admit we don't find really explicitly stated anywhere else, and then you're using that as your kind of optique, your lens, through which to then explore these other traditions. And I think that's an incredibly valuable thing, whether it's a Buddhist project, I'm not really, frankly, terribly interested in, but I think we both seem to acknowledge that it has its roots in a Buddhist insight, whether it's from the Buddha or from Nagarjuna or whatever. And like you, I also struggle enormously with Buddhism. And a lot of what goes, most of what goes on under the name of Buddhism is something I really don't want to have much to do with. It seems to exhibit in many of its forms, whether they be what's written or what's taught or the institutional structures and the hierarchies and so on, to be really quite antithetical to the spirit of a middle way approach, which is, I guess, paradoxical, because after all, we're back now with the tradition that's supposedly been, you know, an initiator, or at least was very influential in stating these principles, and yet doesn't seem to be able to live up to them terribly well itself. In fact, it seems to fall into the very traps that it warns against.
If the middle way, though, as a fundamental principle, was the filter, in the sense that the Buddhist tradition put everything through, whether it be rebirth or whatever, wouldn't that be the safeguard against these ideas becoming dogmatic?
It's a little bit dangerous always to say Buddhist tradition does X, Y, or Z, because Buddhist tradition is rather a big beast. But broadly speaking, yeah, I agree. And I think Buddhist tradition, or Buddhism, or Buddhism as a religion, has basically been co-opted by powers outside that of the, you know, the central vision of the tradition itself. And we see this everywhere. We see it in Christianity. That as soon as you institutionalize or metaphysicize any particular view of the world that perhaps has liberating potential, it tends to compromise that liberating potential. And Buddhism seems to be trapped in that as much as pretty much any other tradition. So I think it's very important, actually, that we liberate these key ideas, like the middle way, from Buddhist orthodoxies and Buddhist institutions. And as someone, I think, said many years ago, the Dharma is too important to be left to the Buddhists. And I think that's probably true. And that sounds a bit arrogant, I agree. And I do call myself a Buddhist, but I wonder why sometimes. And there'll be plenty of people out there who prefer that I didn't. Mm-hmm. But if I'm going to be honest, this is the tradition in which I feel very deeply rooted for my whole adult life. And I feel an enormous indebtedness to it. And I feel an enormous sense of I identify with it very much. But at the same time, I find myself infuriated by so much of what is presented in the name of Buddhism.
If you were once a Buddhist, Robert, why did you choose to apostate?
Come and apostate, yes. Why did I leave? Well, I think I found too many conflicts, basically, and I found, although I learned a lot about the middle way and particularly about its practices and ways of practices that could help one on the middle way from the Buddhist tradition, and particularly from the particular school of the Buddhist tradition I was involved in, which was Theravada, and Sangharakshita's work. But at the same time, I found that in constant conflict with appeals to tradition, appeals to the authority of particular figures like Sangharakshita himself, and appeals to metaphysical concepts, which include not just karma and rebirth, which is a well-known target, but also enlightenment itself and the appeals to the authority of the Buddha. So in effect, the Buddha being used as a source of revelation from a point which is in practice beyond our experience. It's only theoretically attainable by us. And I also felt, I suppose for a long time, I was impressed by stuff like the emptiness of emptiness and the ways in which, there was theoretically a critique in the Buddhist tradition of that nirvana wasn't ultimately metaphysical truth and all that, and the relationship that it has with practice and so on. But very often in practice, in the end, I felt that that critique acts as a spoiler. So people will happily recite this in a puja, a ritual or something of this kind, or they'll talk about it, but to actually use it as a basis of judgment requires another kind of process that is thinking through, well, what does this mean? What does this involve when you apply it to all our ethical thinking, for example? So often the middle way is just sidelined when ethics is concerned and they're wiggling the five precepts or whatever, or monastic rules. What difference does it make to our understanding of science and how we should relate to the scientific tradition and so on. And very often I found also what were given as top billing as kind of the important principles in Buddhism were things like conditionality, which often became, I mean, it's a matter of interpretation, but often became a metaphysical principle itself, or enlightenment, or the three jewels, which are kind of focuses of devotion. And all of those, or the Four Noble Truths for that matter, but all of these things can be interpreted in a way which is compatible with the middle way, but they can also be metaphysicized. So I think it's most important to start with a principle of judgment which tries to head off that possibility of metaphysicizing it in the first place, which means you have to give priority to the middle way. If Buddhism did that, I'd be much happier to call myself a Buddhist than I actually am, but I've yet to come across a Buddhist movement that clearly gives priority to the middle way in practice.
Okay, but why did you not decide to become a reformer like Stephen? Did you at some stage feel that you could change the Triratna to an extent from within?
I did. I had some go at it, but I didn't feel that I was capable of making much impression on that tradition. And I suppose, well, the point where I decided to leave the Triratna Order was after I gave a talk at their retreat centre, Pamaloka, where I did put forward some of these ideas and I actually was critical of Sangharakshita, which is something I felt good at Pamaloka. Having done that and tested the water a bit, I found such a negative response from probably the majority of order members I spoke to about the talk that it became clear to me that most of them, or the majority of them, not all of them by any means, but the majority of them were heading in a different direction or seemed to have different priorities. So there wasn't enough similarity, I suppose, in our approaches on the whole in the end, I felt. It was always a judgment call. It wasn't a clear-cut thing. It wasn't that I decided Buddhism was bad. But it was a question of, could I work within this tradition in a pragmatic way? And in the end, I felt it was better to try and explore ways of doing so outside it. So that's what I've ended up with. But obviously with complete recognition of how much I owe the Buddhist tradition, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, you see, for me, I think probably most Buddhist institutions that we have today are pretty much beyond salvation. And I think that, I think one has to be careful in over-identifying any particular Buddhist school with Buddhism, or at least the Dharma, as we find it in the earliest sources. I mean, I've left several Buddhist traditions. I don't identify with any of them. I'm certainly not a Gelugpa in which I was trained. If anything, I might be more happy calling myself a Son Buddhist, but that doesn't mean much to anybody, basically because they just question everything. But I don't go for all the other stuff. And I'm not a Theravada Buddhist, and I don't belong to any, you know, modern order like the Triratna. I have really no interest in these things. And on the other hand, I do feel a very deep linkage and almost a sort of umbilical link, which is maybe not a good metaphor, but that's just to be honest. And what I found enormously helpful in struggling with these same concerns, but it's sort of a love-hate relationship with Buddhism, constantly a battle, if you wish. But has been going back as far as one can to recover something of the humanity of the Buddha. I mean, my new book will spell this out in a lot more detail than I've done before, to try to recover the Buddha's humanity. This is a similar movement that we find in Christianity. And I think I've been very influenced by Christian theology, as you're probably aware. And some of them, I feel much more in tune with liberal, radical Christian theologians than I do with anyone writing in the Buddhist world today. There's no question about that. Because they're willing to really put aside all of the dogmas, the metaphysics, the orthodoxies and so on, and really ask the deepest questions. You know, why was this person Jesus special? Why was this person Gautama special? And once you start to recover the humanity of these people, it becomes more and more difficult to set them up as icons of ultimate authority and revelation. It begins to erode because the person is no longer so ultimately other than you are. And religion, belief systems, all have to work on the premise that Jesus, Buddha, Muhammad, whatever, are somehow of a different order of being, a different order of humanity. They are somehow God is speaking through them, or the Dhammakaya is speaking through them. As soon as you get to that, you've lost the human person. And at the same time, to take some of these key ideas like middle way. And what's striking about the middle way, for example, is that the very first words that the Buddha says in the very first sermon are, I have found a middle way.
Yeah.
And the very last words he says to the disciple Subhadra, who comes to him on his deathbed, Subhadra says, how would I know whether something anybody teaches is of your teaching or not? And he says, wherever you find the middle way, wherever you find the Eightfold Path. So it's the alpha and the omega of the Buddha's Dharma, as far as I'm concerned, to mix metaphors. But when you get into even ideas like the three refuges, stream entry, a lot of these ideas that have been ratcheted up to the level of non-negotiable dogmas, when you burrow back, you find that they're actually much more accessible, practical tools, instructions for living human life from day to day, not these grandiose things that they have evolved into. So my attempt to recover the Dharma is to put aside all of the Buddhist orthodoxy and all that stuff and try as best one can at this distance in time to tap back into the source. And then that's not an end in itself. That would just be fundamentalism. You know, this is we don't move from here. But I'm interested in trying to get back to a ground from which we can start all over again. And I have a funny feeling that Robert's probably doing something similar, trying to articulate what the key insights are in order to start something afresh, not to repeat the past.
Mm. Yeah, that would be very much fit as a description of what I'm trying to do, yeah. I mean, I wish you luck working within the Buddhist tradition, but I think you're up against a great deal.
Oh, there.
not to be underestimated. And I think there's also another danger, perhaps, which certainly I've detected in failed to have detected in your work so far, which perhaps I don't know if it's going to be ratified in your new book, but the danger of slipping into postmodernism or some sort of relativistic position, that's what my overwhelming impression of many of the Christian theologians who've gone down that route as well. Although, you know, I've worked with Don Cupid, I was supervised by him at Cambridge, and I've got a lot of respect for him, but he doesn't, in the end, for me, have an account of what ethics is and why we should value one thing rather than another if you're not applying to a metaphysical source, and why it's more than a question of preference or a question of convention, how we should act. And that's where I think that the middle way offers a way forward, you know, that we understand what is better or what is the good. I think some things you said earlier, Stephen, but that we understand the good in terms of the middle way, that the in terms of the avoidance of delusions or ways in which our views may get stuck, and that our moral judgments need to aspire to meet that and to avoid the delusions of, you know, not of any ethical theory, but of getting stuck in one particular theory as the final solution, you know, any one particular moral principle or any particular approach like utilitarianism, for example, as the final single way of correct way of doing ethics. So I guess that's the thing I overwhelmingly find missing in a lot of these more modern critical treatments of religion, in a way, mm-hmm. that they haven't really grasped that nettle of what ethics is and why it's important.
Yeah, but you see, this is, I think, exactly what Buddhism can bring to these people. And I think Don Cupid, in at least some conversations I've had with him recently, sort of acknowledges that. He says the one thing that's different about Buddhism is it might actually work. No, seriously, certainly. He says has a good chance of being able to work. In other words, it's actually something that has a sufficiently coherent underpinning to translate into an ethical life that's not just, you know, postmodern relativistic, we do, you know, or seem and so on. Yeah. And I think that's the case. So I feel that the people like Cupid and others, another one, Rorty, I'm kind of into Rorty as well, but again, we're not going to Rorty. What I found that they've been very helpful in allowing me and helping me to deconstruct Buddhism. But I feel that what that's brought me to is a set of principles and values that could, I think, be enormously valuable in giving a lot of these modern critical thinkers some kind of focus, some kind of coherence, some kind of value system that is not metaphysical, that is not sort of fixed in views, but is nonetheless supported by a very sound an ethical perspective and vision. So I think the two coming together is what interests me, really.
But surely that applies, doesn't that apply to any other tradition, that if you interpret it in terms of the middle way, mm-hmm. you know, if you interpreted Christianity in terms of the middle way, you would end up with something provisional and useful.
Yeah.
So there's nothing intrinsically superior about Buddhist ways of working, apart from the fact that it articulates, or to the extent that it articulates the middle way.
Well, that may be true, but I would agree with you. But the point is, whether you like it or not, you're still bringing in a Buddhist idea to help guide you in your thinking. That you are, ultimately, if there weren't Buddhism, would you be plugging away at this idea of the middle way?
Certainly not in terms of personal history. No, I wouldn't have encountered it or come to understand it, certainly. I'd acknowledge that. But it's just that I think if you emphasize the Buddhist nature or identity of the middle way, then again, you've got there's this danger of alienating people from other traditions that, for whom, you know, it could be just as important.
That's what's attractive for me, actually, Stephen, about Robert's approach, is that very point. That I mean, I love your work, and you know, I've been on many retreats with you, and I'm sure I'll be on more. And but it's the universality of the idea that Robert puts forward that I find is a lot more accessible potentially to a lot of people. When we think of a term like pragmatism, we don't call it Deweyism or whatever. We're interested in the idea behind that particular concept. And that's what I like about the middle way. You don't have to tie it to it. You can make an acknowledgement, you know, how important a source Buddhism is for the middle way. But as Robert says, you do find interpretations of it in history in all fields of human endeavour.
Yeah, well, I'm completely sympathetic to that approach, and I sometimes I do agonize over the fact as to whether I should keep myself within the Buddhist camp, because as Robert suggested, you get a lot of flack. I mean, I get people out there who actually hate me, you know, the serious Buddhist scholars and people who think they know what's what. I'm not popular in many circles, but I also have a considerable number of people who may or may not self-identify as Buddhists, who find that I give them a way into Buddhism, into Buddhist practice, that they probably wouldn't find anywhere else.
Sure.
And so I find this to be a considerable dilemma. But I'm still also struck by, let me just take another example, mindfulness. Mindfulness has now become, you find it everywhere now, and it's being adopted in all sorts of different realms, and there's always some vague acknowledgement that it's Buddhist this, Buddhist that. But I think that's actually a failing to acknowledge something. I think there is a kind of Trojan horse process going on here. I think mindfulness and maybe down the road middle way philosophy, these are, I think, ways in which Buddhist tradition, however sort of reformulated and reimagined, are ways in which contemporary culture, let's say global culture, are being influenced and being directed in different fashions by the ideas that are essentially Buddhist. I don't like the word Buddhist, frankly. It's a modern invention. It only started being used in the 19th century in English. In English. I'd much prefer to use the word Dharma, but again, that's full of problems as well. Perhaps we need to abandon all of these kind of jargon terms. But the problem is, as soon as we set ourselves up to articulate any kind of coherent vision, we have to give it a name.
Yeah.
We can't just call it Robert Ellisism or Stephen Batchelorism. No, we're speaking beyond our own particular personalities, and we are looking to find and to locate principles that we are deeply committed to and value, and to articulate them in ways that we hope will enable people to lead more flourishing and more rich and more compassionate and more humane lives. And I don't think it's just, I think that perhaps the point that differentiates us is perhaps a willingness or a different sense of where on the scale of things the Buddhist element comes into play. I think it probably comes into play more than, let's say, the mindfulness people are willing to acknowledge. I might be wrong, but I get a hunch that mindfulness, middle way, right livelihood, that was a term that was popular some time ago. These are all kinds of, these are media, these are concepts that allow Buddhistic values and ideas to filter into a non-Buddhist world. And I'd be perfectly happy at the end of the day that we drop terms like Buddhism altogether. I don't think it really matters at all. But at the same time, I do think we need to be honest and we need to be upfront about where the sources of our inspiration are coming from.
Yeah, no, I agree with that.
Sure, I think it's definitely one thing to acknowledge the sources of inspiration. But you also used the term essentially Buddhist a bit earlier on then, Stephen. Did you really mean that? Is there an essential Buddhism that's working its way out in this way?
No, not as I'm very wary of. If I use the word essential, I really apologise. That was a bad move. I spent a lot of time at one point, especially when I lived in England, and we had all of these interfaith Buddhist groups, and we tried to define what is Buddhism. Mm-hmm. Hopeless, completely hopeless. Mm-hmm. You can't do it.
Mm. Yeah, so as long as you acknowledge that, I mean, that obviously Buddhism is not a entirely fixed thing. It's a process, it's a tradition, it works its way through and influences in all sorts of ways. But, I mean, my work is not just an outcome of Buddhism. It's also, there's a lot of stuff from psychology, mm-hmm. Embodied meaning theory, aspects of philosophy and also Ian McGilchrist's work on the brain and so on. Yeah, so are fed into it. So I think there's ways it's an outworking of those as well. And you could take this from another point of view. You could say, oh, this is all psychology and it's part of the history of psychology. Or you can even see it as an outworking of Christianity. I'm sure some theologian at work right now, some young theologian on his PhD thesis about how new forms of Buddhism are really Christian and so on. It's a particular gloss you can put on it and if it gives coherence to what you're trying to do, that's great, but I don't think it can be essentially that any more than it's essentially anything else.
And I agree with you. But I do feel that there is, let's say, a cluster of core values or something like that that inform Buddhist tradition and have informed Buddhist tradition through the centuries. And we could, argue as to what they are. I don't think it's terribly important to try to pin them down because everyone will come up with their own list. But I suppose I would in some senses. And then the middle way kind of captures it all for me. I mean, you've got the you sort of sideline the Eightfold Path a bit. I don't. I think the Eightfold Path is not a Buddhist. It is Buddhist in an obvious way. But to me, it's just shorthand for a complete human life. I don't see it as anything other than that. And I think that's the beauty of it. I think what has happened is that Buddhist tradition has tended to isolate certain elements of the Eightfold Path, particularly mindfulness and concentration and right view, terrible word, and so sort of just made that into the main thing and has basically sidelined and forgotten everything else. You can go through the suttas, you'll hardly find anything on livelihood or speech or it's just not there. And so the very tradition itself has self-selectively privileged certain aspects of the Dharma that were clearly the primary preoccupation of the monastic communities who had a vested interest in preserving those elements. And so what comes down to us is not the Eightfold Path anymore. What comes down to us is basically a variant of Indian renunciant religion that seeks to achieve salvation through not being reborn, according to the ways in which Buddhist tradition has preserved or developed certain strategies and soteriologies and so on. To me, that's not the Dharma. That's something that has evolved historically. But once we get back to the early sources, and I'm sorry to keep going on about this, but I found that this has to me been the most exciting thing in my studies of Buddhism all along, is this recovery of origins. And rethinking classical terms. And I find something very different back in the source than I do in pretty much every form of Buddhism that is available today. And so I can discard Buddhism as you do in terms of the institutions and the metaphysics and the dogmas and so on. But I do think that they do stem from a source to which I do feel an enormous attraction and affinity. Without trying to reduce it to some sort of dogmatic essence. Mm-hmm. I see Buddhism really as an organic, as a bit like an animal, as an adaptive organism that mutates and evolves according to the new environments that it continuously finds itself in. And in this current day and age, the environments are so different to any of those under which classical forms of Buddhism emerged that the form of adaptation is going to have to be very radical. One image I've often thought of is that Buddhism needs some very, very radical surgery, and it's questionable as to whether the patient will survive the operation, is my sense. And perhaps that's what, you know, both of us are doing in a way, is we're doing a sort of radical surgery. Buddhism may not survive that surgery, at least Buddhism as we know. And what comes forth, who knows?
Indeed, yeah. Just going back to what you were saying about the Eightfold Path there, I do very much agree that there's some very helpful elements there in the way that the Eightfold Path interrelates different ways of working. The idea that we need to work on different things at the same time at different levels, like that we're working in terms of, in a broadly meditative terms, we're working in terms of our beliefs and views, and we're working ethically in terms of our behaviour. I suppose that's why I actually always preferred the threefold path as a kind of simpler formulation of that. But at the same time, you know, you could just put that in different terms, couldn't you?
Probably.
Yeah, do there have to be eight limbs of it? You know, there are potentially different versions. So presumably, I guess your deeper point is that we need to understand that there are different elements of the path and that they hang together. You know, that there's a synthetic process involved.
Well, not only that, but I think we have to, and this is one of the things I really can't stand about a lot of Buddhism, is that when people talk of my practice, they usually, almost entirely, they refer to sitting on your bottom, cross-legged, and doing some kind of spiritual exercise.
Yeah.
Now, the word practice, bhavana, applies to every single one of those eight steps. Yeah. In other words, I think it's a huge mistake to privilege certain aspects of the path as the practice, but instead to recover an idea that the whole of your life is a practice.
Yeah.
To give as much importance to the person who's, you know, developing a company, but to give as much importance to a person who's, let's say, a communicator or working, supporting a family, all of these activities are practices. And not to privilege monks in monasteries meditating. Mm. Meditation, nonetheless, I do think, is an important part of an integrated life, but not to privilege it.
Yeah.
So for me, the Eightfold Path, well, there's 8, 9, 10, 11, doesn't really matter. But it's to acknowledge that practice it has to be an integral activity that embraces all aspects of who we are.
Okay, well, I'm very pleased with that, Stephen, that we found so much to agree upon, and I wish you luck in your quest to reform Buddhism, which deserves as much support as it can get, really. And I hope there'll be similar quests in other traditions as well, with similar lines.
Very good.
Okay, well, thank you very much to the pair of you for a very engrossing chat today. I really enjoyed it.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for organising it, Barry. Very, very, very much indeed. It's great. I'm really pleased to have met Robert, at least virtually.
You can find out more about Middleway Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.